How do politicians think about transport? How do we engage with the world of politics? How are we seen in the world of politics? Let's talk to Stephen Bush, Associate Editor of the Financial Times, and find out. Welcome to Freewheeling, the free-thinking podcast about moving forward faster. My name's Thomas Abelman, and each week I'll bring you fresh voices, new ideas, and unconventional thinking. So let's get started now with this week's edition of the Freewheeling podcast. I'm joined today by Stephen Bush, Associate Editor of the Financial Times. Now, I invited Stephen not because he covers the transport brief, he doesn't, but he's the only political journalist I've encountered who actually properly seems to get transport policy. You, my listeners, will know that sinking feeling when you open a newspaper and see an article on transport. And it's the sort of misunderstandings and the simplifications that often make you feel like it's kind of unhelpful that it was written at all and you'd rather no one had ever started. Well, that's never my reaction to a piece on transport by Stephen Bush. So, Stephen, welcome to the Freewheeling podcast.
Thank you very much for having me, and thank you for that that very kind introduction. I will now, of course, say something incredibly stupid in about 10 minutes' time on this podcast, but thank you very much and thank you for having me.
That's fine. I'll edit it out in 11 minutes. It won't be a problem at all. So many of my listeners probably don't know you as well as people in Westminster do. So just quickly tell my listeners a little bit about your role and what you focus on at the FT, because it certainly isn't just transport.
Yeah, so I write our daily politics newsletter, Inside Politics, which is kind of either a sort of thought about something that's in the news that day or an ongoing debate the thing to understand about, because obviously there are loads of stories where you have a sort of where visibly a spending department wants one thing, the Treasury wants one thing, Downing Street wants one thing. One of the things I try and do in the newsletter is bring out where power is actually shifting and what's actually likely to happen. So, I mean, for a transport context, for example, visibly, I think Downing Street has bought into this kind of slightly oversimplified myth than like the problem with... Now, obviously, a partial problem with buses in England is that councils do not have the required regulatory levers to run bus services. But the cause of that problem is that from 1950 to 1985, bus journeys go down everywhere in England, and car journeys go up. Margaret Thatcher has her kind of ID fix, which is, well, we'll just privatise this and this will magically fix the problem with the 85 Act, which doesn't work. But there's this disease, I think, in the Labour government, and broadly speaking, all you do is unpick the 1985 Act, and hey presto, you have 1950-style bus services. And so I kind of try and navigate for our readers what's going on in politics, and then I have a column on the terrifyingly broad brief of ideas. But because on my day in the paper, we've got the geopolitical commentary, geopolitics commentary of Gideon Rachman, who will, I think, now essentially always be doing Trump, and Sarah O'Connor, who does a brilliant column largely about the labour market. So I basically do soft public policy. So, yeah, welfare, schools, and then the other thing I love about transport is it's my sort of most manly bit of policy I get on that day, seeing as it's not quite labour market and it's not war either.
And you talk about this need to sort of navigate what's going on between the various areas of government. And that's something that most political commentators don't really seem to try to get into. There is this sense that covering politics is about the he said, she said, who's up, who's down, politics a spectacle. And one of the things I really like about reading your work is that you do seem to actually be interested in the policy outcomes as opposed to simply the people involved. And is it my sense, or is that actually kind of surprisingly rare for someone in your profession?
Although I think there are loads of honourable exceptions, I do think there has been a really strange trend, which I've experienced within my career. In that at the start of my career, when you'd write a blog about policy, a fun thing afterwards is another journalist who also wrote about policy might disagree with you, and you'd then have a fun argument, very like a nice sort of enjoyable, like, well, actually, I think this matters more than why. And I think then it's partly, I think, about changes in media consumption, and it does feel increasingly to self-promote my own newspaper than almost ever, it does feel almost all of the really involved policy reporting and writing now happens within the FT, which I think is great for our readers, but not, I think, that good for discourse as a whole. And I do feel increasingly a lot of people really do seem to regard public policy as an annoying diversion in these kind of 4 years where you'd much rather be talking about elections. Oh dear, now we've got to grit out 4 years of talking about like the optimal structure of local government, or 4 years of talking about tax reform until we can get to the most important thing, which is people voting, which obviously voting is the most important thing. But the reason why it's important is because it changes the public policy choices. And I am, you know, an unashamed public policy nerd. So, you know, I mean, like, it's one of the, like, it is, I think, genuine, actually, I think we don't appreciate how exciting and unique it is within the whole span of human history, right? Thing we haven't done for very long, which is to come together to come up with, like, in some cases, astonishingly ambitious solutions, right? Like, I understand why they don't do it, because obviously TFL has a huge number of, you know, demands on their purse. So having loads of plaques talking about how cool the engineering involved is understandably not in the top 100 list of things. But you know, the stuff that even stuff like Crossrail discovered, you know, the stuff that it had to navigate, the unexploded bombs, it's just, and that is a thing that broadly speaking, no human being had ever done until a bunch of weirdo crank entrepreneurs started building the London Underground. Public policy is just really cool, right?
At that age of ambition, it feels like I'm saying something very sweeping here, but it did slightly feel, when I remember going down into the Elizabeth Line on the first day I was working at TfL at the time, and it was kind of wonderful, and in two ways. It was wonderful because of the extraordinary sweeping spaces. I also loved the fact that all the customers were acting like it had always been there. They were just sitting there, reading their papers, looking at their phones, navigating the stations as if they'd been doing this for the last 30 years, which was kind of very British about it. It was wonderful. But it also felt slightly anachronistic, this sweeping, spacious, no expense spared, if we're going to do it, we'll do it well. We don't really feel like we have that level of ambition at the moment. When I spend a lot of time talking to people in transport policy from the practitioner side, and anything that feels beyond a step forward from where we are now incrementally, just it won't happen, it's too hard. Have we kind of given up on ambition?
Yeah, I think we have. I think you're exactly right about the Elizabeth Line, in that it's beautiful. I love it. You know, I live in King's Cross. I have relatives in the States. I was using it to get home from the airport. Yeah, it is obviously a wonderful adornment to the town. But it feels like a throwback, right down to the fact that architecturally, it is what I always think of as Blair Wave public project in its colour palette, in its style, in its wonderful arched building. But broadly speaking, we have, since the financial crisis in the United Kingdom, stopped commissioning genuine ambitions. You know, you see it with Manchester Piccadilly, right? What should we be trying to do there? We should be trying to build King's Cross and Pancras too. So it should be underground, so you have them all. And although there are lots of people, including, of course, the mayor of Greater Manchester, you know, rightly saying this, advocating for it, a lot of the time, even in the sector and even among the kind of republic of letters, as it were, of sort of like-minded nerds and policy writers in this space, often it feels like you'll say this and people are just kind of like, oh, well, you know, that's not going to happen. And I think there are a variety of reasons. One, I think there has been a slightly unhelpful forgetting of the history of public transport in London, which has been replaced by this myth. So instead of this kind of slightly weird story of a bunch of entrepreneurs building a thing, trying to make money from it, creating this, we shouldn't forget that I think I'm right in saying that it's actually only when the Elizabeth Line completes that more than half of the London Underground network is a state built structure, and we therefore sort of forget what is actually possible in public policy. So if you say something like, in addition to having fast trains that link the whole of what ought to be the whole conurbation of, you know, from Leeds, Bradford, which really ought to be one city from a transport perspective, all the way to Manchester, people start to go things like, oh, but you know, that would be difficult. And what about the mountains? And you go, guys, you do understand that the Victorians dug a longer length of tunnel for the Central Line, an utterly mad project. From, if you imagine trying to get like the, you know, doing the BCR on that, you know, as I'm plagiarizing your own opinions of your blue sky, but you know, you just wouldn't get that through. And I think then what's happened is that we've forgotten the history of why London has great public transport. We've forgotten the scale of what the state can do elsewhere. And so it kind of leads to this kind of, this lack of ambition, this almost fatalism, right? And broadly speaking, the only thing you can do in transport is like build fast links to airports or whatever, which actually depressingly, one of the things that's top of mind is obviously I only relatively recently just got back from visiting relatives in the States. One of the things that we do very well in transport infrastructure in the United Kingdom is airports, which is great in a way, but it is a little bit bleak to feel that the thing that we're really good at, it's a bit like when people champion the benefits of South London and how quick it is to get to the centre, and it's like, so your killer argument for your side of the city is how easy it is to live, how easy it is to leave there. And like maybe the whole of the country is becoming like Forest Hill in that respect.
The point you make about, we obviously should be treating Leeds and Bradford as one conurbation, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There's a graph that the Centre for Cities produced in a report somewhere, and it shows the correlation between the size of cities and the productivity of cities. And for European cities, it's a diagonal line. It's a really clear diagonal line. The bigger the city, the more productive. And at the one corner, you've got Paris, and then it just goes straight the way down from in a diagonal line. Then you look at the line for the United Kingdom, and it is completely flat. As cities get bigger, they are no more productive, except London, which is up in exactly the same position, same size, same productivity as Paris, more or less. So our cities are not generating the productivity benefit they should be with their size. Then you look and see, and also London's the only one of our cities that has a meaningful public transport system. The others kind of don't. And you say, for a government motivated by economic growth, and we all know that productivity is the key enabler of improved economic growth, I admit what I've described is a correlation, but it seems a remarkable correlation if it's false, that making better public transport, making cities work, wouldn't drive productivity. Yeah, I kind of, whenever I say this to anyone, including some people at the Department for Transport, they kind of, laugh at me, it's not quite right, but it doesn't feel like this is on the agenda as a big solution to our big problem. Am I right?
Yeah, I think you are. I think there is a sort of, obviously, as you say, it's a correlation, but actually, I think also if you zoom out and sort of, let's not just think about it in terms of public transport, partly because one of my pieces, I think we often get in this trap where we talk as if spending on roads is like nature, just a thing that happens, doesn't count. Spending on public transport is a weird extravagance. But if you add US cities to that, which are where size and productivity go together, yes, most US cities do not have decent public transport, but because of their size, they have and choose to have road solutions of a kind that just aren't an option if you're a European city, right? The reason why you need public transport to be your solution if you're a European city is you ain't going to be able to move people at speed with big Los Angeles-style roads. You are only going to do it with the Milan Metro, with the London Underground, with something like that. And I do find it a bit odd how, I mean, I get why on the political side, of course, the problem is that no transport project is going to return the productivity benefits you need within the political life cycle, which means that, of course, governments are always encouraged. It's why, the thing I always say to be self-aware about the Crossrail business rates levy, right? On the one hand, it is a bit of a democratic problem that no one in London has ever actually been able to vote whether or not what they want is for businesses to be taxed to pay for Crossrail, right? On the other hand, Crossrail is great for London. And even as a big, as a big enthusiast for transport, one does have to be honest about, in the event of a local election or a mayoral election, if the option was as simple as use this money to pay for Crossrail, use this money to make your estate repairs happen a bit quicker, I think estate repairs are going to win. And I think that because transport's always in that politically difficult zone, it kind of ends up being a thing people don't bring up, and then they therefore forget it. They actually forget that there is, of course, like a very obvious, I would say, lever. Not least because, look, all of us who use public transport in the modern interconnected era have at some point done some work on public transport. Now, I know some people do answer emails and calls when they're driving, but I wish they wouldn't because it's incredibly dangerous. And they also do it less, thankfully, because it's quite dangerous. So, yeah, I think it has become a kind of forgotten lever, not least because, air one of my more right-wing opinions, I do think it's always worthwhile states asking themselves what are the things that we know they can do reliably and well. And actually, building public transport links is a thing that governments do well. Picking winners and other aspects of industrial strategy, because of course, public transport is an industrial strategy. Yeah, like, the Jubilee Line extension is pure industrial strategy. Yeah, like no one in the Thatcher and major governments talked about it in that way. But the industrial strategy is, oh, we've got a thing we do really well called financial services here. We've got the kind of people who work there who live out in, you know, in suburban London, in Stanmore Sister. We'll make it easier and quicker for them to get here. It literally does go through both. It's industrial strategy. But it's industrial strategy of a type that governments are good at delivering and can deliver reliably. And also, history teaches us that it doesn't look like Canary Wharf will be a financial services hub of any kind for very much longer. But there'll be something there. You know, maybe it'll be biosciences, maybe it will be some kind of advanced AI, maybe it will be, you know, but there will be some form of economic activity there and people will move to and from it. And so it's a lever that government should be more excited about than they are.
So how do we get out of this then? Because you're right that at the moment, the sense you get is that the current Labour Party policy is actually believed, which is, oh, we nationalise everything and suddenly it becomes better. Done, yeah. Problem solved. Yeah. The perception that every city outside London has massive untapped productivity that could be solved by public transport is not on the agenda. So sort of advise me and my public transport sector listeners, how do we get out of the position we're in at the moment?
So I think the political opportunity, the moment of political opportunity is also going to be the moment of political risk, right? Which is that Labour has this idea that you nationalise a bunch of public transport services, you don't do anything new in terms of regulation, you certainly don't do anything new in terms of increased CapEx, you don't do anything new in terms of revenue subsidy, but magically the DfT will run these railways much better than they've been run privately, despite the fact that, of course, we all know if we list the best railways in the country, the best railways in the world, there just isn't a sort of clear, oh, state good, private bad, or indeed private good, state bad. You just do have to do certain things to have good railways, whether the state or the... But I think there is going to be a moment of opportunity to basically go, okay, well, look, you've done this thing. It's not working. However, now the risk is then what happens is to go like, we've done this thing. It's not working. Time to go for, well, I think for Labour would be too embarrassing to denationalise. But, you know, then essentially you shift from privatise and forget to nationalise and forget to privatise a third time and forget. I think there is a moment to go, look, actually, the crucial thing is how you are behaving as a commissioner of services. There is like a moat, and I think that within the failure, right, my assumption with all of this stuff is it would be too embarrassing for everyone involved if Greater Manchester were not to get a flourishing bus network. So the government will throw quite a bit of money. Obviously, in the grand scheme of things, it will be negligible because it doesn't actually cost that much. But, you know, there will be a successful bus system in Manchester, but everyone else will basically have the situation where their council will be given a bunch of theoretical powers that they can't use because they don't have the money or the means to cross. Yeah, there is no instrument of cross subsidy, right? We should never forget that TfL is a train company with a really, really expensive hobby running bus services. Now, of course, that is simplistic because what was the number one bus journey I took? In my old home, it was to go to Finsbury Park. Probably if I were driving, I just wouldn't ever get on the tube. But yet we know then broadly speaking, bus services do require, if you want something better than what we have now, they require that degree of public subsidy. And I think, yeah, the moment is going to be like, look, okay, well, you've done this deregulation thing. You've had your better, i.e. the state does it thing. You're still not getting what you want. Why is that? And that, I think, is going to be the moment because, like, I don't think the Labour government is going to want to throw up its hands and go, the problem is we were completely wrong about nationalisation. And in some ways, even though, well, not completely wrong, is maybe unfair on my part. Although nationalisation is sort of incidental, because they won't want to admit then it is incidental, the opportunity to go, look, here's how you make this work better, which is also coincidentally, here's how you'd make it work better if it weren't nationalised, is a good one. But yeah, the risk is, you know, it fails, you get a Conservative government, which is also, I don't agree with Andrew Gilligan on a number of things, but, you know, that brief moment of having someone in Downing Street who did Albie with his own, to my mind, slightly odd grudges about aspects of it, where it's like, this makes no sense other than a collection of one man's weird beefs. But that moment of having a government and did believe in it, and an opposition which believed in it, I don't think that's going to come back. So the important thing is finding a way to refine what the government that believes in it does, because otherwise, yeah, it will be, you know, conservative government who basically thinks in the ideal public transport solution is for everyone to have a car.
I should say, by the way, my favourite of the one man's beefs written into policy in, of all places, Downing Street, was I think the fact that the National Bus Strategy said that there should be a reduction in route numbers with letter suffixes.
Yeah.
Which I will remember for the rest of my life.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, I don't even disagree. What are they for? I mean, then it's like one of those things where it's like, it's just like kind of a classic of, I understand what this is for from a sort of behind the scenes design thing, but just as a bit of user experience, it is, yeah. But again, it shouldn't have been in a national strategy.
No, I actually disagreed with almost none of his prejudices. I was just amused to see them all written down in that way. I'm going to take a very quick break now, and then we'll come back and talk about us transport folk. The reason for the break is so I can tell you, my listeners, a bit about freewheeling the business as opposed to freewheeling the podcast. In a world which demands ever faster change, it can sometimes feel hard to make that happen. I help transport and mobility organisations innovate, solve challenges, and achieve faster results. If this sounds like something you're interested in, visit www.freewheeling.info. Right, Stephen Bush, let me ask you a slightly different question. One of the things that I think we transport folk do is we assume that all our problems are unique and no one else has it as difficult as we do. And I think probably every sector does that. What I want to know is basically is that we all have the same challenges, or are our problems genuinely hard? We think, yeah, we deal with very long-term infrastructure. We have very complex operations. We have uniquely challenging trade unions. Therefore, it is just much harder for us to get results. Do you think those are unique challenges from your perspective across multiple areas of public policy?
Well, so some of them are unique. I mean, let's take those in order. I think what I understand, I think if I worked in public transport, what I would find frustrating about transport unions, particularly in the United Kingdom, is that they very much have this kind of, you know, you'll have like a conversation with someone who works on policy for a transport union, in which they'll say something like, oh yeah, of course, like this doesn't make any difference. It's a waste of time. Who cares about privatization or nationalization? And then you'll like look at what the proposal they've made to like Labour's NEC or what they've said on Newsnight, and you go like, oh, so the complete... And I get why that is uniquely frustrating, but actually... I would say it's a hell of a lot easier than having a workforce representative which genuinely believes in some quite mad stuff and also can't take its own stuff with it. So when you want to do, like broadly speaking, actually, when you get buy-in for a big, exciting new transport project, the RMT and the TSA are not kidding around when they say, this won't work for our members, but this will. Mm. Whereas if you're, say, trying to, like, reform healthcare, you know, we've obviously got like all advanced democracies, we've basically got a free at the point of use healthcare system that is built around healthcare assumptions, in our case in the 1940s, some ways 50s, 60s and 70s. But if you're trying to improve healthcare outcomes, what the BMA believes it can deliver and what its members actually want are sometimes not even in the same galaxy. So that's an aspect of somewhere where I think actually transport does have it easier, right? Like it is easier to get internal buy-in among all of the transport stakeholders for genuinely transformative and exciting change. Where transport, of course, does have it uniquely difficult is that the horizons are so long. So one of the things most of my career in journalism has been in newsletters. And the thing I always say, I think, which is frustrating about email newsletters, is that we're not new media, right? Like, yeah, we are considerably, you know, the first email is older than our combined ages, right? And then it sometimes means that you're kind of having to fight internally for resources because you're not sexy, right? Like you're not like, oh, you know, let's have a TikTok channel. We have no plan to monetize it. But yeah, like, whereas with the newsletter, you're like, oh, we could do this thing which has been going for decades and we do know how to monetize, et cetera, et cetera. What would be helpful for public transport, not just in the United Kingdom, but, you know, around the world, would be if the kind of person who used to invest in it privately to make a buck still wanted to. And it's not like the profitability of that had gone away, right? It's not like there is no money in public to be made in providing public transport anymore. It's just that it's been around for over 100 years, so it's not sexy or something. That is, a unique challenge. And then I think the sort of specifically UK-based thing, which isn't unique, is that we are not very good at city policy in the United Kingdom. Some people were going, oh, but London. It's like, well, London London and New York are very similar, right? Which is that if you are a big mega city, and London has been better run than New York has, to be clear. But if you are a big mega city, you can absorb some pretty egregious failures in your governance structure because you're so large, right? But if you imagine what a great dynamic city, even more so than they are, New York and London would be if they had had the kind of high quality 40 years of sustained leadership than central Manchester's had, that is a very different picture. Now, that is, of course, a challenge for everyone. But it's, I think, particularly frustrating for those of us who care about public transport because there isn't really an alternative to there being good city policy. If city policy is bad and you're into public transport, you're just kind of stuffed, really. And so I think it is a mixture of things which are hard for everyone and a mixture of things which are uniquely hard for the transport industry. Not least because actually also with almost everyone else's unique problems, I think there are more quick wins or like, you know, $10 bills on the street. And then so, for example, the Horizon, right? It would not make for good public policy if you just went, oh, well, what if government budgets moved from Horizon and suits the other spending departments to the DfT, right? That would just lead to really bad public policy outcomes almost everywhere else. Whereas with almost everyone else's unique political difficulties, there is a more obvious sort of painless solve. Whereas, broadly speaking, the length of an election is also the length of, you know, a whole key stage in secondary school, right? So it is actually a sort of quite appropriate budgeting unit in some ways. Whereas it will never not, we will never not have this problem that, you know, Crossrail, the only big transport project of the last Conservative government, but it's actually the final transport project of the last Labour government. That is just always going to make the politics hard.
And that's why people like, you know, Ken Livingstone came in and really in his first term, everything he did was about better buses. It's why Andy Burnham came in and everything he's done is about better buses because you can do an awful lot with buses. Yes, the trouble is, and by the way, you should do an awful lot with buses, but buses never going to be the thing that turns around the productivity story that we were talking about earlier.
Yeah. Yeah. And this thing, I think buses are really, you know, like one, because like they, you know, they're part of the mix and they are a useful car killer, although a weird problem. Look, I personally don't understand. Yeah, I do actually. It's one of those things where I completely agree with why not just the Treasury, but finance ministries in general look at trams and they just go like, why do you want to do this really expensive, less versatile version of a bus? But the one thing then they are significantly more versatile at is they are just more effective modal shift tools. Yeah. And I think sometimes you just got to throw your hands up and accept it. You've got to meet people where they are. But yeah, the thing that Ken was able to successfully do with buses, it was an immediately tangible change. And I think if you weren't in London in the 90s or 80s, and you kind of don't absorb how tatty and horrible the public transport infrastructure had become, you know, grim vending machines didn't work, you know, almost everything feeling like it was in some state of disrepair. I mean, you know, essentially, anyone who doesn't remember what London in the 90s and 80s is public transport was like, you can recreate it. Admittedly, you've got to pay about 500 quid, but given that Trump is dissuading so much local tourism, might be the price is dropping all the time. Just visit New York and it's basically like that. Yeah. It's just and what Ken successfully did by just having buses that were new, clean and exciting is I think it was a really important part of getting people to believe in public transport again. It's why I feel sometimes in the transport space, I see people getting a bit sniffy about like the branding of the B network and how they think it's a bit unnecessary or some kind of, but I think it's such an important proof of concept to be like, you have a bus, it's now yellow. Like, and I include, you know, this includes things which as a design nerd, I go like, oh, what? Yeah. Like, so is it really necessary to have like the cool nightclub style lighting in like the modern Manchester bus fleet? Like, why is there a charger? Everything? Well, the answer I would say to why is because you've got to physically demonstrate change with the one short-term lever that public transport bodies can pull, which is the quality of your bus fleet.
Yeah. Now, if we want more better public transport, and let's assume for the purpose of this conversation that most of the people listening to this do, you see how multiple different sectors engage with politics. How do we do? Give us our report card as transport people compared to others.
So I actually think people in the official transport policy world mostly do quite well. I actually can, I genuinely only think of one exception, which I'm going to share because I'm still quite salty about it. So a while ago, I was writing about rail nationalisation and mounting my usual hobby horse of it's just really not. Yeah, I was like, even though I did the whole like internationally, this is not a list of this is not a list of nationalisation versus privatisation. Then I went and I hold my hand up to this. This was a stupid mistake. I got the order of like my brackets of this one is actually nationalised, this one is part privatised, this one is fully privatised, but. The London service in question, I got the world's snottiest PR email where it was just like, also, I do kind of think it's sufficiently arguable what TFL, if, is TFL Rail privatized or not privatized? Is, I would argue, supporting my point, sufficiently arguable. And I don't think it quite merited the level of sort of how dare you claim this. Next time you write about TFL Rail, you better get in touch with us first, et cetera, or, or we'll send the boys round. I mean, but the reason why I remember that is so rare. And I would say that is not the case in other sectors. Like, actually, a thing which is fun about writing about transport is even when you get things wrong, which I think is actually the central mistake I think a sector often makes is to get to a position where politicians are scared of it because they know they don't know very much about it, but they feel that if they like try and get close and try and become more fluent in it, and they use the wrong words, or they just are like, that's a difficult box. I'll just return to my home issues. And given the issues that shape elections, home issues for most politicians are always going to be schools, education, crime, and then on the right side of politics, financial services, banking, law, and then an overlap of law on both, in both left and right, because I'll be different types of law. So I actually think the sector is pretty good at talking to people. It's just like, but it is actually just like quite a hard hand, right? Like we know, like, I mean, like, let's think about like, say, actually let's take like the UK's existing trams, right? Edinburgh Council built a tram. It was really unpopular during the construction. There was story after story about how it was a bad idea. If you tried to take it away now, you'd get run out of the city. Croydon's tram, ditto, story after story after story about how that is. I mean, I remember I would have been about 15, 13, my mid-teens. So, at that point, we'd been arguing about Crossrail for like at least 10 years. And someone claiming entirely with a straight face that if they built Crossrail, St Dunstan's Church, which is one of the oldest churches in East London, would fall down a hole. I mean, just like one of those things where, it was like one of those like, tenants association or something. And it's like, well, this is like, what can you even do about that, right? Like, I mean, just like it's laughable, but it's obviously not a good way to win friends and influence people to laugh at people. Like that stuff, I think, actually is just quite hard. Like, because at the end of the day, you're right, there was something quite charming about the fact that there was no period on the Elizabeth line when it felt when people were going like, oh, this is a bit fancy. However, I do also think that does speak to a bit of a social problem we've got to in public transport, because that is not my recollection. And admittedly, I was, 10 and a major train spotter and et cetera, and, I think it was the Wheelies that the London Transport Museum's young scheme was called at the time. But I think people were more reverential and more excited by the new Canary Wharf at the turn of the century than they were by the Elizabeth line. And I think that is part of a broader problem in politics of people, of, because we've had low growth, because we're now increasingly in media silos, of people kind of stopping believing that the communal endeavor of politics can do things. So forget the fact of the problem that people think Tony Blair did the Jubilee line when it's actually a John Major achievement. At least people thought the Jubilee line was an achievement and they were excited by it. There is kind of weird thing with the Elizabeth line. It's, it succeeded well beyond projections. It's transformed the economic geography of parts of the capital. From a selfish perspective, if you're someone who lives on it, who owns your own house, it's been great for your property price, et cetera, et cetera. And yet people do kind of treat it like it just like, then it wasn't.
Always been there.
I don't know what those of us who care about public transport can do about it. Actually, maybe to contradict myself earlier, maybe TfL should be using some of its budget to talk about the engineering challenge. Like maybe making people feel, maybe like publicly reaffirming that we should feel quite excited by this thing that we've all funded and done together would give us some of our kind of sense of possibility back. But that is,
No, so is there something almost the reverse of what you said a moment ago around, you know, you described the one time when you got sort of someone being basically unreasonable, but in general, the public transport people, that's not the case. I mean, are we too reasonable? Is that part of our problem? You know, if you think about some other sectors that just manage to say, we are essential to everything around life and you must keep funding us. And if you don't, all hell will break loose. And obviously, I do get that it's easier for the NHS to say that than transport people. But, you know, are we too self-effacing and helpful and polite as a sector?
Yeah, I think sometimes. So actually, like a real moment of vulnerability for public transport systems, not just in London, but in my experience, everywhere I've gone in the world with a public transport system since the pandemic, not only is ridership down, but I suspect as a direct consequence of ridership being down, the necessary etiquette in order to make public transport run and work well is not in the condition it was, partly because the more people there are. So if you take, you know, Lib Dems, you know, with their proposal relatively recently about fines for people listening to headphones. Now, I think there are loads of reasons why that has got worse since the pandemic. But I think one of them is that the fewer people there, if we imagine in a full train carriage, there are five people who are inconsiderate enough not to plug in their headphones or to sit in silence. Well, that's very annoying for all three of them as well. So they all, indeed, the thing I have discovered always works and is actually the least confrontational way of getting someone to turn their own music off is to put music on. Immediately, you know, like immediately someone understands why it is annoying to have Sabrina Carpenter played through tinny speakers if Sabrina Carpenter is suddenly doing like the world's most ill-advised collab with Run DMC. Look, listeners haven't gone to the Museum of Public Transit in New York. I strongly urge them to do so. Terrific, terrific museum. But we should always be aware that obviously like it's great that what has happened to the subway can happen to public transport everywhere, right? Where you have this brilliant legacy asset, which broadly speaking, you know, a time traveler from 1941 would... Okay, they wouldn't be able to navigate the New York subway very easily because it's still the New York subway and it's really badly mapped and designed. But yeah, but they would be no more lost and it would be no more alien to them. You know, in that time, every other metro has had major extension. Now, that is partly, of course, because of the bad governance structure of the city of New York. It's partly because of local political factors. But it is also because once you get into that cycle of falling ridership, falling interest, you go from having this great legacy that's been given to you by previous generations to this very difficult milestone. Like it was not inevitable that London's transport, that London come out of its long period of decline, then the London Underground turned itself around. And so I do think we have got to get a bit better about reminding people of the stakes.
And indeed, it's not the case now that it's guaranteed even in London. I mean, we talked a lot about other cities, but there is no pipeline of extensions or improvement or growth to the London public transport system. Everything that was going to be built is being built. And every year, TfL is currently underinvesting in the replacement of its existing assets.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're not necessarily staring down a good place at the moment, even in what we already have.
Yeah, no, exactly. Like, we should be really clear that the scenario, if no one does anything to change it, is that the London Underground, as it again becomes one of those places where, you know, the trains are in bad nick, people feel a little bit uneasy because they slipped once and they felt that maybe something dangerous could happen to them. All of that stuff that happens when you don't, when you aren't able to invest sufficiently in your infrastructure. Because, you know, like, it's one thing to have, like, an old but perfectly serviceable train like the old Bakerloo. But, you know, any of us who remember what, like, the old silver sort of, like, the kind of why we used to think of as the screaming central line, you know, the way that that did deter riders, and that was a huge problem for the city. It's important. I think the difference is obviously with healthcare, for example, you can always appeal to people's electoral interests. But I think for transport, it's always got to be partly about appealing to people's vanity. So, like, do you want to be like on the list of people who are why this went horribly wrong? Do you want to be remembered as someone who like left a better legacy for the next person, which again, as I say it, of course, is a unique challenge for transport.
One final question. We're recording this on the day that Mark Carney won the Canadian election. And of course, he wasn't even an MP when he became leader of the Liberal Party and then has now become an MP on the day he won his first election. Everyone says that couldn't happen here, but they have the same system as we do, more or less, and they have a House of Commons like we do. And the only reason I asked that question, you know, in 2029, in January 2029, if the Labour Party is feeling like it's struggling, could they tweak their rules slightly and, for example, bring in the Mayor of Greater Manchester, who is not yet an MP? I mean, everyone says it can't happen, but I don't see why it can't happen, given that it has just happened in a very similar system.
So I think the reason why it wouldn't happen in the United Kingdom is because, I think it's the kind of thing which I don't think can happen in 2029, but I think will happen at some point. Why are Canadian political parties open to being led by people who are not currently MPs but are going to become so? Answer: Canadian politics is incredibly volatile, right? Like, they have we're seeing this in British politics, like an increasingly even distribution of swing voters everywhere. Which means, you know, Pierre Poilievre can go from thinking he's going to be prime minister to losing his seat, which means that, you know, the Progressive Conservatives, the predecessor to the current Conservative Party in Canada, could go from government to two MPs. And most of the rule changes which, you know, both parties have made, which is what allowed Mark Carney to have, you know, to be his party leader but not an MP, are because occasionally in Canadian politics, a party really does get its clock cleaned. Because obviously there is one party where you don't have to be an MP. No, there are now three now, I think about it. But of the established, long-standing, older parties in British politics, the reason why the Liberal Democrats are the one where you wouldn't have to be an MP is because the Liberal Democrats are a party which does stare the loss of all of its Commons MPs or in the face if it gets really unlucky. And so I think, you know, this side of 2029, there are so many egos in the parliamentary party, which is, yeah, there's nothing wrong with ambition, all organizations have it, that there's no way that anyone would ever go like, oh, actually, I have so little belief in myself and we need to change the rules so we can get Andy Burnham in. But I think if, as I think is likely, we are now in a world where, you know, Labour goes from heavy defeat in 2019 to, you know, record-breaking, because actually when you account for the changes in the size of House of Commons, it was a bigger landslide than Tony Blair's in 1997. Parties then have to start changing their rulebook in ways which protect them against really bad years. And once you have that change to protect yourself, you open yourself up to being able to bring in stars from outside. And of course, yeah, like, whether it's in 2029 or later, and it's for governments in office, right, is that they always get a bit tired and they want, you know, yes, of course, Donald Trump really helped. But part of what Mark Carney was able to do is he was authentically able to go, the things you didn't like about the Liberal government, they were nothing to do with me, because they weren't anything to do with him. And so the ability to pull that card and go, thank goodness, let's get someone from outside, I think will become stronger. But I don't think they become stronger in the preferred timetable of someone like Andy Burnham. Although, of course, now I think about it, I don't mean this remotely critically of him as a politician, but of course, actually, the dates do line up more conveniently for him this time around, because I think, paradoxically, because I actually think Sadiq's second term was much more bold and effective than his first one. I think he was a much more deserving winner. But it's not, I think, ideal to have the same person running something for longer than 10 years. There can be exceptions. I do think Sadiq, where he's kind of found his feet in the second term, is maybe an exception of where actually the 10 years is the right amount will turn out to be correct. But it'll be the final 10 years, not the first 10 years, which were about the correct amount. I don't think so.
No, very, very interesting. Well, I hope it does happen eventually, because, selfishly, as a transport person, it is helpful if mayors are actually finding it easier to become prime minister. I mean, the only good thing about Boris Johnson was the fact that he did care about public transport, and transport's something that mayors can make their name in a way that is quite useful as a prime minister. But also, just from a British governance point of view, it feels weird that it's not a career path to leading the country, to lead one of our biggest cities.
So I hope
it does happen.
In general, the talent pool of people who want to go into politics is always going to be, not going to be large, right? Not least because in the modern era of social media, and I think this is unfortunate, but I don't see how it could be reversed, it is much harder for people to go into politics and go back. Which means that you are reducing down the number of people who are going to go. Now, admittedly, I don't feel that sympathetic to this worked example, because he was a couple of weeks before talking about how he didn't want to go back into teaching. Jonathan Gullis is not wrong to say that 30 years ago, a teacher who had been an MP did just go back into the classroom, and that was that, because that's how the internet works. Yeah, that's how not having the internet works. So I think, given the greater cost of leaving your old career, given the number of people who want to do it, I think I understand where the restrictions on double jobbing came from, and I understand they come from a good place. But with the greatest of respect to all of the parliamentary parties, it is never going to be a good idea to go, oh no, our talent pool is so large that we can't have a mayor who's also an MP. Where it can be inappropriate is if you have a very obvious sort of contradiction of interest between your constituency's needs and the area that you're representing. Like, broadly speaking, I can't think of a single well-run city where the suburbs particularly like the central administration. But that's a matter for those individual constituents. I think double jobbing is a big part of how you make devolution work. I don't think it's a coincidence that most of our European neighbours are more devolved and have stronger local government and have more double hatting, right? We wouldn't blink at the, you know, feels like, you know, half the top guys in Macron's government, it's like, oh, they're also a mayor.
Yeah, absolutely. Cool. Amazing. Thank you. Thank you so much for joining me on the Freewheeling podcast, Stephen Bush.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you so much to Stephen Bush, Associate Editor of the FT. And thank you very much to you for listening. Now, you're probably already on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts from. So if you're enjoying the Freewheeling podcast, just quickly go and type a comment, a recommendation, a review, so other people can find it as well. See you next week. Goodbye.